Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 26, 2018. This talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Agivachagoda Sutta, where the Buddha answers the questions put by Vajagoda in a way that teaches in the Dhamma rather than getting into debate about these great questions. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So you've heard me talk about the wanderer Vajagoda more than once. He would come in and out of the Buddha's life and have these great existential questions and pepper the Buddha with him, insisting on an answer. And the Buddha would either just sit quietly, or he would say, "Vajja, it's your questions that are causing you the confusion in your life. Let go of the questions." To make the point that the answering the questions or even pursuing an answer to the questions is just a distraction as it relates to the Dhamma, and that's all that it is. And whether the questions that we're using as our own strategy to continue to ignore ignorance are great existential questions or simply concern about what's going to happen to me tomorrow, it's the same thing and it's the same distraction. And it arises, that fear or worry arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So the solution is the same. The point is made through the posing of the great questions, because they're the great common questions that have been distracting human beings since the beginning of time. It's the same distraction that's present in modern Buddhism today. And if you look at these questions and you look at what religion tries to provide, most religions tries to provide an answer to these questions that the Buddha says at the very best they're irrelevant. And really what he's teaching is that the questions themselves are a distraction from developing his Dhamma. So I'm not going to read the whole sutta. I read the whole sutta on Tuesday and spoke to it. There was a talk yesterday on it. So I'm just going to quickly go through the statements that Vajagoda is making, but not go through it line by line and read every word. And you'll understand what the point of this is. Vajja asks the Buddha, "Master Gotama, is this a true statement? The cosmos is eternal, and only this is true. Any other view is worthless." The Buddha responds, "No." And actually, even the translations, there's more repetition and elaboration on how the Buddha couches his answer, but he's saying no. And he says no to each one of these statements. So I'm not going to say that. I'll just read the statements. And I'm going to simplify the statements too. "Then, Master Gotama, is this a true statement? The cosmos is not eternal. Any other view is worthless. No. What about this? The cosmos is finite and only this is true. No. What about this? The cosmos is infinite and only this is true. No. The soul and the body are the same, and only this is true? No. The soul is one thing and the body another, and only this is true? No. Then is this a true statement? After death, an awakened one exists, and only this is true? No. What about this? After death, an awakened one does not exist, and only this is true? No. So what about this? After death, an awakened one, a Tathagata, both exists and does not exist. Somehow creating an environment where diametrically opposed views can somehow concurrently exist in the world. One of the great Mahayana teachers of all time, Nagarjuna, based his whole teaching and his following continues to this day by making these declarative statements that things both exist and do not exist at the same time. And when you look at that type of reasoning, it's the result of trying to reconcile everything in creation back into one idea where my views fit. It's the essence of wrong view. It's the essence of what the Buddha awakened to as wrong view, by the way, too. And so he's teaching Vajja that in a very direct way. Is that clear, by the way, that how these questions are just a distraction? It also should be clear that when these questions arise in a mind that's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, you can see the essence of grasping and clinging to these views, because we become tenacious in our refusal to let go of these views, even though we intuitively know they're either not relevant or they're foolish questions, which is the title of this. You know, Agi Bhatia go to foolish questions. Sometimes the title is, and often the title is listed as Vachagoda on fire, but it's these questions rooted in ignorance that are creating this fire in Bhatia. It won't allow him to a moment's peace, literally. And again, the setting is that Vachagoda's in and out of the Buddha's life over periods of years. These questions that he won't let go of truly are burning him up inside. After death, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist. And the Buddha responds, no. Vachagoda says, I'm confused, Master Gotama. You have said. Now, the Buddha never made these statements, but because of Vachagoda's conditioned mind towards needing to fit things to fit his views, he decides that the Buddha has said this because it fits his view. But notice, the Buddha never made any declaration. He just said, no, those statements you're making are not true statements. Vachagoda heard it this way. He heard that the Buddha declared that the cosmos, Vachagoda's words, if you have said this, Master Gotama, the cosmos is eternal, the cosmos is not eternal. The cosmos is finite, the cosmos is infinite. Again, the Buddha didn't say yes to any one of them. He didn't declare that these are true. He said that the statement that you're giving me is a false statement. It's a self-referential ego self that insists on having any question that it can conjure up have an answer provided. This isn't working now. Uh-oh. Oh, my tablet just died.
Well, you gave two talks already, so...
So, yeah, I can finish this. So now Vachagoda goes through a series of these declarations, kind of throwing it into the Buddha's face. You said this, because you didn't give me an answer. The lack of an answer is giving credence to the question itself. And of course, the Buddha is simply stating no. And so he says, what about it? Why can't you give me an answer? Why are you resisting to give me an answer? And he asks this awakened human being sitting in front of me, don't you know? And the Buddha says, I don't answer those questions because they're irrelevant. What I do answer, what an awakened person sees is form is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, actually the wording is arise and pass away, assumptions are impermanent, and consciousness is impermanent. What's he referring to? He's taking these great existential questions that Vachagoda has, and he's dismissing them entirely, but not to be rude in any way, to emphasize the point that the questions themselves are irrelevant, they're useless, they're distracting. And he immediately takes Vachagoda's mind and points it back towards an idea that's related to the Dhamma, the idea of five clinging aggregates, which the Buddha uses as a description of the ongoing personal experience of suffering. It's called five clinging aggregates. So immediately he's giving Vachagoda the opportunity to start seeing reality. Now, of course, it's up to the individual. The Buddha never set himself up as a god or a deity or something who has powers beyond human powers that could actually make Vachagoda go to see. You can't, and he never could. That idea is common in some forms of modern Buddhism. It's usually called mind-to-mind transmission, but it's not something that the Buddha ever practiced. And I would bet that if he could do it, he likely would have. Instead of putting people through their paces, he would have just said, you're awakened, you're good to go. And of course, there's even some sayings that said that as soon as a Buddha awakened in the world, we all awakened. And some of you have probably heard that in modern Buddhism. It's just a matter of time for us to realize it or something. Well, why would the Buddha spend 45 years of his life trudging around dusty and somewhat violent northern India if all he had to do was awaken and the job was done? Again, it doesn't make sense, and it's not something that he ever taught. He taught an eightfold path that anybody who encountered it and developed it could do as he did, as he has accomplished, and see as he's seen. We could see the five clinging aggregates as an awakened human being sees, which means, and the Buddha concludes this sutta by saying, rebirth is irrelevant. No rebirth is irrelevant. And both rebirth and not rebirth is irrelevant. And that, it, when you look at those three statements and then look at the grand questions, they all can be simmered down to that idea of rebirth, because they're all looking for a way to establish this thing in non-physical realms. And so that was something that was bandied about then in spiritual circles, much like it is now, about different dimensions and future lives. And this is what you should do to ensure a better life, meaning rituals and practices, or even just a simple morality practice to ensure a pleasant rebirth. And the Buddha is saying by that declarative statement, all of that is irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you're going to be reborn or not, or even if there's a possibility of a concurrent environment of birth and not birth. They're all irrelevant. They're not worth thinking about because they don't relate to awakening. That's an important statement just on the belief in reincarnation. The Buddha is declaring that even that belief is something that you shouldn't even pursue. It's not worth thinking about. What he's also saying is what's most important. He's saying this to Vacha. If you look between the lines a little bit, he's telling Vacha that, though, again, those questions, it's the questions themselves that are confusing you and keeping you from awakening. Let go of the questions. Now think about Vacha's mind without those questions. He's now able to see the Dhamma, isn't he? Because he's no longer holding on to the questions as a prerequisite to what might come afterwards. He's in a sense telling the Buddha, up until the point that he gives up, surrenders, you must answer these questions if I'm going to follow you. And the Buddha says, the questions are foolish. Let go of the questions. Finally, Vacha gets it. He relents and he sings the Buddha his praises now in the sutta. He tells the Buddha how brilliant you are and how important your persistence was in me, in awakening. If you gave up on me, I never would have got it. And he thanks the Buddha for that, for staying with me. So there's a lesson there in both of those people. One, most people would look at Vajragoda as just a pain in the behind. He's always pestering the Buddha. Well, the Buddha never acted that way around him. And so Vacha was really showing, the Pali word is kshanti, kshanti means patient forbearance. Despite how confused and frustrated Vacha would get in talking to the Buddha and not getting a satisfying answer to him, because the Buddha didn't end up engage in debate or try to prove how wrong Vacha was, he left him in peace and said that your questions are what's confusing you, there was no resistance now to Vacha at least considering what the Buddha was saying and what he was portraying by his presence. He didn't shut Vacha down by any type of foolish rhetoric, is what I'm saying. And so it allowed Vacha to keep thinking about it and keep coming back into the Buddha's life. And finally, he got it. The answers that the Buddha gave during this encounter are exactly the same as he gave three or four or five other times. The difference was that Vacha stayed with the Dhamma, and his mind over time was clearing up enough to where he got to the point where it made sense. And I think every one of you would probably say that you had to engage in the Eightfold Path for a while, and then it started kind of falling into place. Is that true for every one of you? I can't tell if you're saying. Yes. Yeah, is it true for everyone?
Well, I'm still getting, I'm not there, but I'm still, I need to keep hearing it.
But now that you have the framework of the Eightfold Path established in your mind,
yes,
now you're able to see how the Dhamma fits.
Yes.
That's the important thing.
Yes.
And again, please say, just shout it out. Everybody would say that's a true statement?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I just can't see you. Mm-hmm. Shaking your head. Maybe you could wave to it. Maybe not. You're all going to be one day with megaphones and yeah. This sutta, as with every other sutta, and Diane mentioned this Tuesday night, when you understand the context of what the Buddha is teaching, what he awakened to, dependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, then you can see how every sutta fits in here. So even though the Buddha didn't mention the Eightfold Path, it's throughout this sutta, isn't it? Beginning with right view and ending it with right meditation or deepening concentration. And again, the Vacha finally realizes it. And then he concludes this by saying, I now take refuge in you, in your Dhamma, and in your Sangha. You have And the sutta concludes with Vacha declaring, you now have a lay follower for life. And it so turns out that Vacha maintained his Dhamma practice until the day he died. So it's a great study in persistence, but also in the great compassion and patience that the Buddha possesses. And the reason why is, when you think about this, the Buddha awakened at 35, 36, and he knew he was good to go. He's got it figured out. There's nothing else for him to do. In fact, he declared that the task is done. There's nothing, he touched the ground, so there's nothing further for me in this world. And yet he spent the next 45 years of his life teaching everyone who was interested the Dhamma. And it wasn't an easy job. But he did it, and he did it because it was the singular most important thing in his life. It was what gave him the most meaning. And you think about an awakened human being, there's not much else he could have done. He wouldn't have taken much meaning in changing the oil on chariots, would he? There was another role for him to give. So when someone walked into his life, and this is the reason why I'm teaching this is what happens. This is the difference between someone who has great compassion but lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths, a bodhisattva, how the Buddha describes himself prior to his awakening, and someone who has wisdom to go along with that compassion. They're able to know how to act in a very skillful way. And so the Buddha was able to do that with Vacha, because he knew what needed to be said, and he was able to cut out all the rest. Next week's sutta gets into this even a little bit deeper. In fact, I got a question today from one of my students. And it's something slightly different. There's a sutta called the Simsapa Sutta, or the Sutta on the Handful of Leaves, where the Buddha's walking through the forest with some monks and nuns in tow, and he reaches down and picks up a handful of leaves, and he says, "Friends, what's more, the knowledge that I have and that is reflected in all the trees, or the knowledge that I hold in these leaves in my hand?" And they said, "Well, it's in all the trees." And he says, "That's like my Dhamma. And I don't teach you the forest. I teach you what's in my hand." Why is that? Because the Dhamma needs to be focused. It's not concerned about answering every common question that could come up or explain the universe. Because what the Buddha describes as dukkha occurs is a description of the universe. It's prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences. It doesn't need an explanation. What we need an explanation of is our relationship to that world when our relationship is rooted in ignorance. That's the one thing that the Buddha wanted to teach, so that we could empty ourselves of ignorance and lose a distraction of these great questions and simply live in peace moment by moment as our life unfolds. That's tonight's talk. Thank you. Any questions related to the talk, and then we'll go around the room. Howard.
Yes. So what you're saying, that he's saying, is that he doesn't have the time, or he cannot afford the time to figure out whether or not he can figure out the universe.
No, it's not that. No, he's not saying that. He's saying that even the mental energy that would go there to try and figure it out is a waste of energy.
That's what I just said.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I misunderstood.
He can't afford the time.
Well, no, it's not that he can't afford the time. It's a waste of time.
Well, that's not being able to afford the time.
Okay. I wouldn't put it that way.
I'm splitting hairs. What I'm saying is, it's a waste of time.
Yes.
For him, because it takes the energy and the time away from what he really needs to concentrate on, which is here and now.
Yes, but it also, the reason why it's a waste of time is most important. More important than just that it is a waste of time. It's a waste of time because it distracts from the Dhamma. And it's irrelevant. Now remember, the Buddha, his only concern is to teach the Dhamma. So if you, and so you come to the Buddha to learn the Dhamma. Much like if you signed up for a college course because you want to go into pre-med, and your first course is a shop class, you're going to wonder why you're there. How does it relate? I'm not learning anything that can help me. You're learning the wrong thing. So the Buddha's not even saying anything. He's not making any declarative statement, even about that it's a waste of time, only that it's irrelevant in relation to the Dhamma. So it would be, because I'm putting my time in, my effort to develop the Dhamma, it would be a waste of time to follow that, to spend my time trying to figure out these answers that have no, these questions that have no answer. So it's an important question. I hope I answered it.
It would even be more of a distraction. It's more a distraction.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the perceived gravity of these questions makes them seem greater than they really are, just because they pose such as existential questions. It kind of seems like they demand an answer, but the Buddha say no, they don't. They're completely irrelevant. But because we get, that's why I say that anatta must see itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to itself. Every thought, word, and idea is a self-reflective thought. So when we come up with an idea, even if it's foolish, that I get the idea that when I die, there's going to be 13 elephants waiting for me. And because I decided that that must be true, or I might even heard it from another great teacher, when I find an awakened human being and I'm a little concerned about meeting those 13 elephants when I die, I'm going to want to know that, won't I? Because now it's on my mind. It's distracting me. So I want to know, listen, I'll listen to you and I'll follow you, but you better answer this question. What about these 13 elephants that are hanging around when I die? And because it's such a foolish question, an awakened human being would say just that. It's foolish. It's irrelevant. But someone who needed to prove how much they know would have a great explanation for those 13 elephants, wouldn't they? And that's just what has happened to a lot of the legend and conjecture that has been added on to what the Buddha taught. We've created great realms of existence to support a self-referential ego self beyond death, which is just what the Buddha is saying, don't do it. It's the biggest trap of all. And the trap, and it kind of goes back to that Simsapa Sutta, I'm going to teach that again soon. We also want to say that the world is the trap. The Buddha describes the world as bait, or the world's bait, meaning we can't help but be drawn to it and hooked by it. But ultimately, the bait is the way that we think, and the fact that we need to attach ourselves to everything that occurs, including these ideas. And that's why even foolish ideas become so difficult to let go of, because they're mine. That's all. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore its own ignorance. Kevin, good to see you tonight. I'm glad you made it.
Good to see you too. How are you?
I'm good.
All right.
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
I don't really have much to add. I did skim over the sutta before class, maybe only 10 minutes before, but really, really enjoyed it and want to read it again.
Yeah.
Does this point to sort of a misapplication or misunderstanding of dependent origination with
Shigoda? Yeah. In fact, you could say that most of the divergence from the Dhamma is just that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really good to see that, because it has taken a directed effort to either completely ignore dependent origination, I'm talking about to develop these modern theories, completely mm-hmm. ignore dependent origination, or modify it to such an extent that it has no relationship to the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, which is what has happened in another book called the Abhidhamma, which is unfortunate part of the Pali Canon. But the Abhidhamma gets into this mystical and cosmological view of dependent origination that has no bearing at all. But that abrogation of dependent origination then allows for anything else that follows, because it can now fit into what we're saying is dependent origination, even though it's not what the Buddha awakened to. You're right to see it. It's from that point that all the trouble began.
And this was later, was this the last time Vachikota came to the Buddha with these types of questions?
Oh yeah.
This was it.
This was Vachikota got it, and there's other stories now.
How far along in the teaching career of the Buddha would you say that?
It's almost impossible to tell, but even in that section.
First half, second half.
There's not even any reference to who else might be there, except you know that it's Ananda, because of the way I didn't start with the sutta. The sutta begins with "Thus have I heard," so we know it's Ananda's recounting. It really, the only thing I could do is speculate, and so my speculation, my guess is it's probably about 20 years in, just by the terms that he's using and the way that he's referring to those terms, I would bet. But honestly, it could have been 5 years in or
perhaps
42 years.
Question
in.
I could let go.
Yeah, but I mean, I always think about that just to try to put things in a chronological order is sometimes helpful. Like I know that the first three suttas when they were given, but there's a historical accounting of that. It's a good question. Glad you made it tonight, Diane. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Relate to this foolish question thing, because sometimes I can get in a mind lock merry-go-round where, I mean, in some times it has consumed me, mm-hmm. you know, for a good part of the day, and when all is said and done, because of the teachings that are very slowly seeping in, I realize this thinking is not getting me anywhere. This talking wouldn't do any good to this person. It's foolish. And
because it's idle chatter, it will fall on deaf ears.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
That's right speech. Great.
And then, some of what I've been studying and researching is right speech, right intention, right view. When I, you know, into this, you know, melee of thoughts that I've been having, so it's probably been a good exercise for me. But the foolish question, I mean, I think my conclusion was ego is basically very immature.
Yeah, that's why I say an awakened human being is a fully mature human being.
And
the
it's
perfect description of it.
Not, you know, that is not something that is, you know, widely broadcast.
Nope. In fact, it's really just even the word ego, and the common psychological use of the word ego is slightly different, but it just fits. You know, we can't start getting too worried about semantics, but you know that's the best description. A self-referential ego self is anatta. It's the five clinging aggregates. It's karma. You know, you bring up another good point, Diane. That it's not just this sutta, and actually one I'll teach next week, I think, is related to these great existential questions. But the questions themselves are common questions, and they're rooted in the hindrances. In other words, Vajragoda is showing indifference to the Buddha's Dhamma. He's showing skepticism and doubt. And any questions that we use in that way are parts of the hindrances that the Buddha said to be aware of. And because it's so simple and basic, we tend to overlook it because we want these ideas to be more meaningful than they really are. It happened a lot here. You remember how many... It hasn't happened a lot here because... most of the people stop coming, but there'll be people coming here to these classes knowing what I teach, but insisting that if the Buddha was alive today, he would teach something different. And that's come up over and over again. And again, I'm sorry that people don't keep coming back and get the Dhamma, but these people aren't here anymore. Because it's more important that they find something that fits their view than to follow what the Buddha actually taught. Again, it's the common problem. It happens all the time. It happens here, but it happens everywhere. And that's the underlying need to accommodate what the Buddha taught to fit a view is so strong that nearly everyone has done it because they treat it like a religion. Now, a religion has to have its doors must be open to everyone, and it has to have a way to reach as many people as it can or it won't survive. So there's no problem with a religion saying, yes, I have the answers to these great questions. Sometimes they're couched in the religion themselves. The Holy Spirit is considered that in most of Christianity. The great mystery is the Holy Spirit. So that houses all these things that we can't explain, doesn't it? The same is true about almost every established religion, is they have a Holy Spirit type actor in their structure that allows for the reconciliation of everything that we can't explain. The Buddha said, no. If I can't explain it, it's not part of my Dhamma, because then it's a distraction. And what I can explain is this. Things arise and pass away. That's what Kandana got. All conditioned things arise and pass away. What as Tathagata sees is the arising and passing away of form, the arising and passing away of feelings, the arising and passing away of thoughts, the arising and passing away of perceptions.
Including the need to have answers to those questions.
That a Tathagata doesn't have the question. A Tathagata sees the arising and the passing away. What does that mean? To an ego's mind, that seems like almost nothing, doesn't it? What kind of life is that? To only see the arising and passing away, until you realize that that is a mind that is able to actually hold in mind everything that's occurring as it's occurring, because it's present. That doesn't mean that as an awakened, fully mature human being, I understand what's happening on the dark side of the moon. Why? Because why would I even think about it? It's not important to me. What's important to me is who's in front of me and the quality of my mind in this moment. And because I've developed the Dhamma, because I'm an awakened human being, because I see the arising and the passing away of all things, my mind is at peace. And it doesn't matter what's arising or passing away in front of me, because I understand the process. And because I am now in the process, because as the Buddha declared, there's nothing further from me in the world. I'm no longer attached to the world, then I can be in the world in a peaceful way, because there's no me in the world. There's no I making. Do you see? Nothing's taken personally anymore. A question like what happens to me after I die is a personal question, isn't it? I need to know. Or I at least need to know, if I'm lucky enough to become awakened, does an awakened one get to move on? That's what Vajragoda is asking. And the Buddha is saying an awakened one wouldn't move on because they're beyond moving on. It's not a concern anymore. He's smiling. I hope you're all smiling. I wish I could see your faces. But
yes.
Howard, so good to see you tonight.
So good to be seen. So it's only important for me to understand what's important for me to understand.
Yep.
And the rest is irrelevant.
The brilliance of my friend Howard. Only understand what you need to understand. There's a lot of skills that we need to live in the world. You know, we need to be able to drive a car and answer the phone and write out a check, et cetera, et cetera. Those aren't things that the Buddha's talking about as even irrelevant or relevant. They're things that we need to do as human beings. What the Buddha's sole concern and where his brilliance comes is from a well-focused and useful Dhamma. And that's all that his concern is. So those other great questions, if we're concerned about awakening, the best thing to do when I'm thinking about, oh, what's going to happen to me when I die, or I wonder what happened to the Buddha, it's just to acknowledge that I'm distracted in this moment and come back to the breath, period. Nothing else. We don't judge the fact that I'm caught up in that. It doesn't matter, because even the thought of, well, why am I thinking this way, or it's wrong that I'm thinking this way, is itself irrelevant, but can prove to be a distraction. So come back to the sensation of breathing. Hug a tree. Good to see you, my friend. Kevin, good to see you.
Then coming to it through meditation, and then learning about the Eightfold Path, I'm beginning to see that it is irrelevant, and it is a refuge to know that it's something that can give me moments of peace. You know?
It's incredible. Thank you, Kevin. You got me thinking of my interest in Eastern things was really peaked when I was 15 or 16 years old and I saw a movie called Lost Horizon. Has anybody seen that movie? Anybody?
Yes.
It's a great movie. It's probably still around and it's worth looking for. Anyway, the movie. Pardon me?
I've heard of it.
It's a movie, it even says it's based on a true story, maybe or maybe not, based on a flyer during World War I, I think, who crashed in the Himalayas. And, you know, it, rather dramatic, but he makes it to this beautiful valley, Shangri-La, and where he's taken care of, and he slowly starts realizing through the way things are that some of the principles live for hundreds of years and they have certain powers. Anyway, I was so influenced by this that that's really what got me thinking about Buddhism in general. I had no idea what it really was. But the catch for me was just that I could figure out there's gotta be somebody that can teach me these superpowers and I can live for hundreds of years. I can be clairvoyant and I can fly around the cosmos. And I didn't care about learning anything about who I was in relation to the world. I wanted to have powers and not everybody else did. I wanted to be special. So, and that's a motivation that a lot of people have to gain understanding, even if it's spiritual understanding, to give them a little bit of edge. And the Buddha realized that too, that this competitiveness and this acquisitory nature that human beings have was just as common during the Buddha's time. And it's to be recognized as a hindrance, as that very first hindrance, the need for constant sensory stimulation. The Buddha points it out. It's another reason why, you know, I concluded our course with the hindrances, but also to emphasize something that is often dismissed in modern Buddhism as not all that important, or kind of look at it like Christians might look at the Ten Commandments. The hindrances are a key to awakening, because if we allow them to continue to be hindrances or fetters, we'll never develop the path. And that's exampled here. So thank you. Debbie, good to see you on a Thursday.
Yeah. I don't have anything to add. I love what you said about the refuge. Just continuing to work on absorbing it, integrating it in my life, and get rid of the chatter.
Yeah. Glad you made it tonight. All right, we'll finish with Metta as we always do. I can't think of, it might have been an announcement or two. Our retreat's coming up in a couple of weeks, so if you haven't signed up and you're joining us, please sign up. All right, we'll finish with Metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And these are the Buddha's words on Metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.